We've gone through an extraordinary 24, 36 hours in the city. We've gone through an extraordinary time here at the station with a remarkable group of dedicated professionals and news people. And we had a remarkable night last night. I had a remarkable night last night in terms of what I expected and in terms of what I saw. We had a four-hour program last night, and we had dozens and dozens of calls from the kids and the young people who were affected. And I was afraid, frankly, at the outset of the evening that we would be talking all evening with people who were so affected that they would be reaching out for a variety of solutions and quick fixes, and that we'd get bogged down in discussions of a politically correct and regimented society as a response to a tragedy like this. But what was outstanding last night was the kids, the young people. They were eloquent, they were gutsy, they were courageous, and almost to us, each and every caller, they understood one thing, and this theme kept being repeated by them. We can't fix everything in society, but what we can do is extend a hand to everybody, people who look different than us, people who act different than us. We are responsible for our communities because we're going through life together. And it was extraordinary. We did 4 hours. We could have done another hour or two. These are extraordinary young people in this city, and the level of maturity and eloquence and guts that they displayed was remarkable. Out of the trauma and tragedy of yesterday, I think came a triumph of human spirit in the city that will last as a legacy far beyond any discussions of politics or policy. It's the human element that's going to be important. But tonight, even though we'll be discussing what happened and other what happened in Montreal yesterday and other issues with a couple of guests, we want to hear from you. If any of you have anything you want to get off your chests, if you were witnesses, if you were students, if you were parents, please call in. We want to hear from you. 514-790-0006. Our hearts and minds and our thoughts are with those parents whose children still lie in hospital, and particularly, obviously, with the D'Souza family following the tragic death of Anastasia D'Souza. And one thing that angered me today as we were reading about this excuse for a human being, this damaged soul who committed these egregious acts, that he somehow either on his website or had said that he wanted to die either in a hail of bullets or in a scene out of Romeo and Juliet. And I was angered by this because these people, evil cannot appropriate beauty. The words of Romeo and Juliet do not belong to the killer. They belong to Anastasia D'Souza. And perhaps her family will find some comfort from the very words from that play that Robert Kennedy quoted at the funeral of his brother. And it's in Act 3. And I just want to read these five lines. And I'm just going to change the masculine to the feminine. "And when she shall die, take her and cut her out in little stars, and she will make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun." And that is to the family of Anastasia D'Souza and the memory of Anastasia D'Souza. In Montreal, we'll be right back with our first guest after this. As I said in the opening, we still want to hear from any of you who were there, who lived through it, parents, anybody with concerns, anybody who wants to get something off their chest. We're going to do a little reflection tonight, and we want to do it with you. And to look at this kind of break in the established order, you need to take an intellectual step backwards, and I couldn't think of anyone better to do it with than our first guest. Adam Daifala has been a former member of the National Post Editorial Board. He's the co-author of Rescuing Canada's Right. He's studying law at the University of Laval, and I couldn't go on with all the other things that he's that he's done in a young life, and has become, to my mind, one of this country's most prescient social commentators. Adam DiFella, I want to welcome you particularly for your patience last night. We had Adam waiting for an hour and a half and 2 hours, and the calls are just coming in. And Adam, thank you again for your patience.
Hi, Beryl. Don't worry about last night. It was an excellent show with fascinating guests, and I enjoyed listening to it. So good job on that coverage.
Thank you, Adam. You and I have talked over the past couple of years about the need to, on a political level, the need to protect this country from and to reverse this country's knee-jerk attitudes that to every problem there is a solution.
Mm-hmm.
To everything there is not a season. And if you heard my opening comments, I personally, I mean, I've talked, I've given many, many speeches, and I talk to audiences all the time, and I was really surprised at the young people who called last night, and they seem to have gotten it better than a lot of the talking heads who are talking about more control of this, more control of that. When the kids last night, the young people last night, were talking about community and reaching out their hand to people that would be considered outsiders and going through life together, that was, it was phenomenal for me, because I realized that they understood that in this world, not only do you need to have common humanity, but you need to have self-reliance. And it surprised me. Should I have been surprised that this young generation understands that?
I don't think so, no. And obviously we have to keep in mind that these are people who were directly affected by the tragedy, and they were still being hit quite hard emotionally from what they had seen and what they had been through that day. So, I mean, these were the raw feelings that were coming out, and it was an emotional evening, you're right. But it's amazing, as you say, if you contrast the comments that we heard on your show last night, Beryl, with what we were hearing from some of the country's leading politicians. Premier Charest made actually some very, very good and decent comments. But you had people like Jack Layton, who immediately took the opportunity to question whether guns that this person had used had come across the border illegally, and that needed to be looked into, and, you know, we have to crack down on the border. We had people like Daniel Terp.
So jumping Jack Flash Layton was here again.
That's right.
Never, he never misses an opportunity to miss an opportunity.
To say the least. But Daniel Terp last night was on television and made an allusion to the fact that, you know, he didn't directly say this, but he made a comment that made it sound like he was trying to scaremonger about the conservatives and their desire to repeal the gun registry. And he tried to emotionally link that with what had happened yesterday, which I thought was just completely beyond the pale, especially given the timing. So, the political response has been a little bit lackluster from certain corners and decent from others.
I was what I was struck, as I said, the presence of mind of the young people last night. And I found that reflected in, frankly, the Prime Minister's comments.
Mm-hmm.
When Mr. Harper said, look, this is a tragedy beyond comprehension, but we have to draw a line between freedom and security.
Mm-hmm.
And that needed to be said, and I think that took great courage for someone to say it at that moment, precisely in that day. Yet, while I'm sure people were discussing what kind of a statement the Prime Minister should make, and there must have been some who said, well, you know, let's not come out that clearly, what was being thought of by the Prime Minister was being reflected in the minds of the very people being affected. They were of one mind on this. They didn't need, you know, there was something that Charest said yesterday that struck me, that they would be giving over the dossier to the Minister of Education for reflexion. You know, I always get worried when politicians want to do reflexion, but what Harper was saying was reflected in what the young people were saying, and I thought that was a tremendous coming together.
Yeah, that's an interesting link that you've drawn there. Harper's comments were good. I think there was a lot of immediate overreaction by some public figures and others who were already talking about, you know, the need to crack down on security and, you know, can we go on and this and that. But, I mean, obviously everyone is still in an extreme state of shock that this has happened. But, you know, Lauren Gunter, who was on your show last night, my former colleague at the National Post,
right,
I think said it best when he said that this is not something that gun control would have stopped. This is a random act of just senseless violence by a crazed person. And unfortunately, there are people like that in the world, and there always will be. And there's really nothing that you can do about it.
Adam, on the public policy level, I almost had a feeling that things like the gun registry do more damage to the national psyche, particularly at times like this, because they don't work. In other words, somebody once called it the revolution of rising expectations, that if the government can just do something, say something, create something, everything's going to be solved. And when it's not, as it's not nine times out of ten with these quick fixes, society at large, the soul of society at large is bruised because people begin to lose confidence in themselves.
Right. Well, that's it goes again back to something that Lauren said last night, which is that it's very important to not rush to reaction and rush to action in a situation like this, because the immediate reaction for a lot of people is to call for a new program, to call for rules changes, to call for, I don't know what, metal detectors to be installed in all public buildings. But you have to go very, very slowly and get over the emotional trauma of the event before discussing it. And unfortunately, that's just human nature. Human nature is to want to do something to try to make it go away and to try to make it not happen again. But it's just something that we can't really do anything about, as sad as that is.
Adam, please stay with us for a moment. We're just going to take a short break. We'll be back with Adam DiFalla, author of Rescuing Canada's Right, and It Really Is a Blueprint for Society. We'll be right back. And you can email any comments after the show to info@iapm.ca. Our very special guest right now is Adam DiFalla, former National Post editorial board member, co-author of Rescuing Canada's Right, and It Truly Is a Blueprint for a Societal Revolution. And we've been reflecting on what should and shouldn't be done on a policy level following an event like this, not to raise expectations of a population. And once again, I have to say how impressed I was yesterday by the young people. And Adam, let's take a call from one of those young people. Would you mind?
No, that'd be great.
Okay. Monica, you're on with Adam DiFalla and myself.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good, and you?
Okay.
My comment really is I've been listening to the radio all day, and it's I've been listening a lot about the gun registry in Canada and if it's safe enough and only the military should be able to have guns. And I kind of have a comment to make upon that. It's basically guns don't kill people. People kill people. And it's very hard for the Canadian Gun Registry to register every single gun that's put in people's hands. I'm in my 20s, and I can tell you this, it's very easy for me if I want to buy a gun to go buy a gun illegally. It's 6 degrees of connection. You know people. Yep. These people know these people. There you go, you have a gun. I think that people are focusing really on, oh, guns and this and this and that, but you have to understand that the problem comes within the person that has to actually buy the gun and decide to use it the way he did yesterday at Dawson.
Adam, this is what I was saying to you earlier.
Well,
the young people seem to get it. The talking heads don't. So this is your question, Adam.
Your record of sterling and unblemished callers has continued. Because Monica is, of course, absolutely correct. There was a great line, I forget who said it, it was something like, saying that guns kill people is like saying that pencils cause spelling mistakes. Of course people kill people, and if someone is as mad and as crazy as this disturbed young man obviously was, he's going to find a gun no matter what and do what he did. Because as Monica said, you can get guns. Legally or illegally. Interestingly enough, this is a bit of an aside, Beryl, but it looks like, at least according to reports today, that this man's gun were, in fact, registered. So if those reports are corroborated and that turns out to be true...
Oh, yeah, and he had a license.
Right. So, I mean, what does that say? What does that say about
that,
the registry?
That tragedies will happen, but let me just... Monica, let me just ask you a quick question, because
yeah,
the lines are beginning to build up. And of course, this is something Adam and I were talking about yesterday, and what impressed the hell out of me last night for 4 hours. Your generation seems to understand something that the older generation doesn't. We've had all these talking heads, well, we have to do this and we have to do that, and psychological counseling and new laws because the young people will be affected. I've talked to dozens of young people over the past 24 hours, and you guys seem to get it. How come you're getting it better than than the old folks.
I think that my generation or the younger generation seems to understand it more because we're more... Well, it's not a censored subject when it comes to us. We're more involved as to what's going on, who's doing what, what's being done. And I think that when people start to say, oh, well, because this gun wasn't registered or this gun was registered, but we don't know exactly the mentality of the guy, but they have to go through this and that. I mean, anyone could have a gun. And I think the older generation doesn't seem to understand that nowadays you can probably make a phone call to one of your friends or one of someone you know, pick up a gun and buy it and carry it around in your purse.
Right.
Or carry it around in your jacket or carry it around in your school bag.
Well, Monica, I got to say about you what I said about so many dozens of your colleagues last night. You've got guts, you've got eloquence, and through this tragedy there's a triumph of will. And Adam, you know, they talk about Quebec being different than the rest of Canada and demanding more from government, less self-reliant. I don't know. I think tragedy is bringing out a triumph of will here, a will that maybe has been sorely lacking, and maybe people are misreading Quebec.
Well, if your callers are any indication, then yes, they are.
It's been remarkable. Adam DeFallo, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. Sorry about last night, and thank you for your patience and your wisdom as always.
No problem. Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Montreal will be back after the Burt News. I want to talk right now, and we're going to be taking callers, and we still invite everybody to call who in any way wants to express an opinion about yesterday or was involved. But I want to discuss right now another aspect that was important yesterday, and it's important not just to this station or this industry, but to this community. Edward Murrow, the great broadcaster, once said that media, news media, radio, and television have a responsibility greater than simply diversion and entertainment. Before we had the catchphrase of interactivity, he said that the community must be involved with the media and the media must be there for the community. This station showed that yesterday. Its coverage was broadcast across the country, uninterrupted by other stations. Members of the news team were on American networks from Chris Burry, the program director, through producers Margot Edwards, Melissa Wheeler, news people Luciana Papilla, Sean McMahon, I hope I'm not leaving anybody out, Jim Duff, who Michael Dean, who ran extra shifts. This was an extraordinary performance. The operators who pulled shifts, Chris Bumbry, Nick Mays, but the frontline reporters on the ground made the story real to people, gave them a connection to it, and really brought comfort to many in this city who didn't really know what to make of this, didn't even know what to make of some of their own feelings. Sabrina Mirandola not only was at the hospitals, but was in the newsroom for hours on end. And we're going to talk now to someone who hasn't slept very much in 40 hours, who was literally in the line of fire. And something else Murrow once said, that the big story is always made up of the thousand little stories, the thousand portraits. And Lisa Fizette painted those portraits, not only for all of Montreal, but all of Canada yesterday. Lisa Fizette, congratulations on yesterday and today, and how are you doing after 40 hours without sleep?
I'm okay. I'm looking forward to having a really long nap, though.
Well, congratulations on yesterday. It was remarkable. You got to the scene pretty early. I mean, you were hiding behind cars at one point.
That's right. You know, we got a call in to our control room, and Chris Bumbray had the presence of mind to come into the newsroom and say, people are calling about shots being fired at Dawson. I'd say that was about 12:42 yesterday afternoon, really right as the shooting started. I was out of the newsroom probably about a minute and a half later, and I was at Dawson at about 1 o'clock yesterday, and there was still shooting going on when I got there.
And that was the time they were clearing people out and all those dozens of police cruisers and the cops running all over the place.
That's right. Ambulances and police officers were arriving on the scene as I got there. Students were being evacuated. It was a mass evacuation. Kids were running into stores on St. Catherine Street. They were running out of the building with their hands over their heads, and they were going one way, and I was going the other because I wanted to know what was going on.
You anticipated my next question. There weren't many reporters that were ready to be there on that corner. In fact, I dare say at that time there were maybe two or three from the electronic media. And so you were at that corner, and you know, I'm watching this on television from the helicopter, and I'm seeing cops running down St. Catherine toward Westmount Square, cops running the other way to Lexington Plaza. You're smack in the middle of this. What do you, as a reporter, what were your instincts? There must have been a certain degree of fear, but instinct takes over. What do you do when you're in there, and what were you thinking when you're seeing all these cops running back and forth about your own personal safety and about where the story is heading?
You know, to be quite honest, I didn't think about my own personal safety during yesterday when everything was going on. I didn't think about it. I thought about it later. But all I remember really about that moment was the students who were running, the students who were screaming, and I couldn't figure out why. The police couldn't figure out why. It really was chaos. And what really sticks out in my mind is a police officer turning around, looking at me, his weapon drawn. His weapon was pointed at me, and he's going, "What's going on?"
The police officer is asking you.
That's right, because he turned around and he was looking. He couldn't figure out what was going on, and he looked at me because I was just there, and he said, "What's going on?" And I had no idea what to say to him. And at that point, that's when another police officer, a plainclothes officer, came over, grabbed me, and pulled me down behind a car. Because they didn't know at that point why the students were screaming and running, and there was still that question of possibly a second, maybe even a third shooter.
But we heard that police had entered the building very, very shortly thereafter. Weren't they talking to their colleagues on their walkie-talkies or any communication systems?
I imagine they were, but you know...
What I'm talking about is the two police officers that came in responding to a drug call. There was a call for a drug bust, so there were two policemen inside.
And it was those two police officers who other officers are saying really helped keep the situation to, unfortunately, one fatality, one student being killed. But it could have been far worse. And I was a homicide investigator who told me that today, that, you know, they reacted very quickly and it really helped keep the number of victims relatively low. But in all of that panic, all of that chaos, when you've got hundreds of kids who are screaming and you don't know why, your instinct kicks in, and that's what the police did. They had to act on instinct because, for some reason, the students had seen something that the officers hadn't.
Lisa, could you stay with us? You know better than most that we've got to just pay a short bill here. Could you stay with us through the break, and we'll talk
sure.
to Francis, who has something to say about the gun registry. And I think you have something to say about that as well.
Sure.
And the causality. We'll be right back, Montreal, with Lisa Fassette. And you can email us your comments at info@iapm.ca after the show. And we're reflecting, of course, today on the past 36, 48 hours. Traumatic time, but a traumatic time that showed a demonstrable triumph of will by Montrealers. And Lisa Fassette is with us, who brought the media to the people. And her coverage, 40 hours in Sabrina Mirandola at hospitals, really made Montreal know that there's a source out there that became part of their community. Lisa, I'll keep you for another few minutes. I know you haven't slept in 40 hours. We're going to welcome Francis to talk to us. And Francis, you've got some things to say about the gun registry.
Yes, Bill. It's good to talk to you again tonight.
Good talking to you.
Yeah, there's actually a couple of things. First, now that you're talking about the media, I'd like to say how I'm disappointed in a couple of our news networks here in Montreal. 940 was on the ball from the start. However, I was at home at one point. I was watching on the TV, and I was watching TVA. But when I flipped to CBC, when I flipped to CTV, when I flipped to Global,
yeah.
Not one of them had anything on until 4 p.m.
Francis, I wanted to mention that. I'm glad you did, because I wanted to laud the work of Lisa Fassette, Sabrina Mirandola, On the Ground reporters. And Lisa, I wanted to ask you this when you were describing what happened on that corner, and I'll tell you why without mentioning names. Excuse me. As I was watching in the office, I noticed that there were, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there was you on the ground, there was one other reporter, and there was one TV reporter. And as Francis said, as I'm flipping channels, I'm seeing all the other TV reporters reporting it from a
from a camera, helicopter camera. Now, that struck me that there were a few of you that really went out there and put yourselves on the line there, and a lot of reporters, as Francis says, were watching it on the monitors.
I actually have one thing to say, Beryl.
What?
I actually saw Lisa on the TV because they showed a picture
right.
from the helicopter. We actually saw her on the ground.
Right.
And it's just insane how nobody else was there.
Lisa, is that an image that we all have? And I had it too, so I didn't want to say it until Francis, somebody brought it up, but now that Francis brought it up, is that what happened with the relatively few reporters at the beginning?
By the beginning, I mean
an hour or two.
I don't know. I can honestly say myself and a colleague from Infosys, Katamedis, as well as a couple of cameramen and a few photographers, we were the first people there. We were the only reporters that I actually saw. We were able to get through before the larger perimeter was set up. I cut through a couple of backyards, and I cut through a couple of parking lots that I probably shouldn't have to get where I got. And the perimeter was very large, and the media was restrained, and it was hard to get information yesterday, and it was extremely difficult to get around. I will give that to my colleagues. It was difficult yesterday.
Francis, what would you have liked to see from the media?
Honestly, it's not that. Some of the other channels were actually using feeds from other TV channels just to get something on the air. But some of them didn't have anything at all. I mean, the American networks had stuff on before our own networks did.
I think CNN was using a TV feed, and don't forget that some of the American networks were actually interviewing reporters from 940. Lauren Schwartz,
right,
I know, was
exactly.
on Fox.
But at least they had something on. They had something on air, whereas local channels had nothing.
That they did. Francis,
now,
yes, sorry.
Just the other thing was for the you were talking before about the gun registry. I mean, they're honestly. One of your previous callers said it the best. There's nothing you can do about it. Even if you put in as many laws as you want, the black market exists. No matter what, somebody can get a gun if they really, really want to. And causality, the guns don't kill people. People kill people, but they use guns to do it. That's a statement that has to be used. Instead of guns don't kill people, fine. People kill people, sure, but guns are the main tool to do it.
Lisa, this is something that, as you've been hearing, that really impressed me and touched me over from last night and the dozens of calls. The young people weren't looking for quick fixes. They seemed to have the guts and the eloquence and the presence of mind to understand that tragedy in life happens. And one thing that four, five, six callers repeated, we're all human. We've all got to reach hands out to those that may be misunderstood, and that's our only protection is within a sense of community. And I was inspired by that last night. I don't know if you got to talk to a lot of the kids, but did you sense that these kids were not as that out of the tragedy and out of the trauma, there was a great deal of steely will. They understood what society was all about and what community was all about.
I did get that sense from a lot of students. In fact, I was back at Dawson this morning, and I spoke to one boy who was there laying out flowers, and he was dressed in that goth style. You know, he had on the dark makeup and the nail polish, and he had, you know, the goth-like clothing. And I asked him, I'm like, aren't you worried, considering that how the shooter was described, that everybody is going to paint you with the same brush that they're painting him with, and that, you know, you're full of anger, you're full of violence, and you're full of hate? And he told me he didn't really care what other people thought, but that not everybody should look at him as an example of what the goth culture is necessarily, and that he had no intention of going out to kill anybody, and that what the shooter did was wrong, and there was no excuse for that. And the kids were really out there to support one another and really lend that support. And you could see it yesterday with the kids who were hanging around, and they were holding hands, and they were hugging one another, and really they understood, like you said, what happened.
Well, Lisa Fassette, again, congratulations to you, to Sabrina Marindola, everybody here, and Lisa, a well-earned sleep.
Thank you.
Go relax. Great job.
Thanks.
Montreal, we'll be right back. Or email us with your comments after the show at info@iapm.ca. You know, one theme that we've been repeating that the young people involved in the tragedy yesterday, the students kept repeating yesterday, and we've been reflecting on today, is that there are no quick fixes in a society. That a lot of the things have to do with on-the-ground police work, reaching out to people, solid intelligence, sometimes making knee-jerk law doesn't resolve anything. And I've been wanting to speak to our next guest for the past 48 hours. We've had this scheduled, but of course, the tragedy at Dawson overshadowed that. Yet I think it's important to have a brief conversation because it's reflective of what the quality of a society is and what the quality of our society will be. Lawrence Greenspun is a well-known criminal lawyer. There's a lot of civil liberties cases from Ottawa. And Lawrence, I want to welcome you and I want to thank you for agreeing to come on. I know time is pressing from both ends, but I wanted to talk about this week.
Sure.
Lawrence Greenspun is a lawyer for Momin Khawaja. Now, Momin Khawaja faces charges under our Public Security Act that was passed in the wake of 9/11. Lawrence Greenspun is challenging, we won't get into the details of what Momin Khawaja did or didn't do, but Lawrence Greenspun's challenge of the act itself is important for all Canadians to understand, and I'm just going to quote Lawrence, and I want to just turn it over to him for him to tell us what happened and what happened in the arguments today. Lawrence Greenspun's argument made the point earlier this week that the fault, the difficulty, the prejudice of our security legislation is you don't need to know when something's going to happen, you don't need to know how it's going to happen, you don't need to know if it's going to happen, you don't even have to have any knowledge. So what can determine culpability? Lawrence Greenspun, welcome again, and could you tell us how this affair is going and what your arguments were?
Well, the legislation, the Anti-Terrorism Act legislation, was passed in record time at a time when 9/11 was very fresh in the minds of people all around the world. The United Nations Covenant 1377 asked the nations of the world to take measures to try and deal with terrorism, and the Canadian government response was the Anti-Terrorism Act. Unfortunately, in their rush to legislate, they put into place a number of definitions, things like terrorist activity and terrorist group, and they also, in the course of doing that, brought into our criminal law or into the Anti-Terrorism Act motive. In other words, the fact that somebody is doing something for a political cause or a religious cause or an ideological cause became part of the Terrorist Act offenses. And by doing all of those things, by poorly defining terrorism, by bringing in motive and other such things, what they did really is opened up the terrorist laws and its enforcement and enable these enforcement agencies to look into people's religious beliefs and their political beliefs, their ideological beliefs, and by doing that infringe on fundamental freedoms that are supposed to be constitutionally protected under our Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So the argument really is, look, you've crafted a law, you've crafted it badly, and it infringes upon fundamental freedoms of Canadians and therefore should be struck down. And that's really, you know, what we've been trying to convince the Superior Court judge. You heard the case over the last 4 days. We've been trying to convince him of that. We finished our arguments today, and he's put off his decision till the latter part of October.
We've made the point many times on this program that as much as war against terror is justified, as Churchill said, democracies have to be stronger and never mirror what we seek to destroy. What good is it to send the best of our young people in harm's way if we end up here curtailing the rights of ordinary Canadians with electronic oversight on our email, internet telephony, electronic anklets for preventive control measures? This is a slippery slope, is it not?
Well, it's at this point we're well down the slippery slope, and you're quite right. One of the points I've been trying to make is one that actually Kofi Annan has been making for the last couple of years, and that is that the greatest thing that you can do is to stand up for human rights, and when you do that, you stand up against terrorism. The greatest tool that we can use to fight terrorism is the protection of our civil rights and our human rights. Because that's the one.
You'll forgive me, Lawrence, if I say I would faster agree if Lawrence Greenspun said that than if Kofi Annan said that. But be that as it may,
it's a tool that we have. Our government in the past has been all too quick to trade the rights of people for the promise of national security. And I fear that we're in the process of doing exactly that all over again with the Anti-Terrorism Act. We've done it with the Chinese Canadians.
Yep.
We've done it with the Japanese Canadians. We did it in the province of Quebec in 1970. And Canadians, unfortunately, many of us have been far too willing to allow the government to make that trade on our behalf. I'm not willing to make that trade, and I don't think many thinking Canadians, people who are concerned about fundamental freedoms, are prepared to allow that trade to happen on their behalf.
I would agree with you there, and with this is another case where quick fixes aren't solutions to anything. And Lawrence, we're short on time, but I wanted to get to talk to you this week. And if you would permit me, we'll call you back on Monday, where perhaps we can have you and Julius Gray on to discuss this in broader depth.
That'd be great.
Great, Lawrence.
Look
Lawrence Greenspan from Ottawa. Thank you very much.
Take care.
Montreal, little has left to be said after so many hours of trauma and tragedy. But once again, I want to say to the Souza family, our thoughts are with you. And to quote again those beautiful lines that are so applicable to your daughter, and when she shall die, take her and cut her out in little stars, and she will make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun. That is the legacy of your daughter and of no one else. Good night, Montreal.